So, you know, as Barbara mentioned, it's very difficult to follow somebody who is as passionate as the patient, who shows the typical heroism that we've come to take for granted in this building. And, you know, as I look around the room, I see champions in innovation, both from industry and academia. We've worked very closely together as partners in our race to get rid of the cells that still reside in people even after our best efforts to eradicate them. And those cells we call cancer stem cells. And I want to say that when I look at the champions around the room that have really made it possible to make a difference in terms of patient care and being able to hopefully eradicate these cancer stem cell populations, I think first and foremost of the patients that have made this possible. So all the work that Kelly and I will talk about today is based on patient samples, building better preclinical models that we think may have predictive value, as Dennis alluded to, who has been our fearless leader in our Serum Disease Team grant. Serum has taken the stance, fortunately, that patients really matter, and the faster we get into clinical trials that are more effective and target stem cell pathways, the better. So thank you, Karen Berry and other representatives of CERM. In terms of talking about the survival mechanisms that cancer stem cells use, I think we really need to look back at the molecular evolution of cancer stem cells and to talk about what cancer stem cells are, as Michael Karen was alluding to just there. Really, we're talking about the cells that persist even after therapy that targets rapidly dividing cells. And the reason we think these cells persist is because they're not susceptible to anti-proliferative agents because often they're dormant. So they go to metastatic niches, particularly the bone marrow, whether we're talking about breast cancer, prostate cancer, or leukemias, which we tend to focus on, and they get instructive cues to go to sleep. And that makes them intrinsically really not very responsive to a lot of our therapies. Now, there's been a lot of controversy about the cancer stem cell field because people think we're talking about cells that have the same cell surface markers as a stem cell. And that's not really what we're saying. What we're saying is there's a population of cells within a cancer that has co-opted certain stem cell pathways. And what we think now is that we can target those particular stem cell pathways in combination. And I think that's where we'll have most traction. So they evolve as a result of sequential mutations in these stem cell pathways that regulate differentiation, self-renewal, survival, and dormancy. Now, when you look back at Charles Darwin and what he first started to look at when he was a little kid, he looked at the variation in plants and was just a very curious child. He actually didn't do that well in school, and he did theology, interestingly, considering his theory became so controversial. But really what he was looking at when he was a child was the variegation among plants in terms of plants that had been grown in different environments. And then when he went on the HMS Beagle to the Galapagos, he was really looking at finches and how they changed in a natural setting. So he was looking at the changes in the beak size, and that sounds incredibly boring. But anyway, he was able to follow ancestry and lineage tracing and find what species or what subgroup really was able to survive the selective pressures. So he talked about, if you look at the origin of species, there are titles to each chapter. He was very reluctant to publish this work, and he didn't publish it for 25 years because he thought he might be wrong, and he thought it might be too controversial. And then he heard that Wallace, who was this young British naturalist, had a very similar set of observations from the studies that he did in Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. So he thought, I'm going to get scooped. And so he decided to put his abstracts together and talked very closely with Wallace and said, hey, let's do this. And they actually presented their work at the Royal Society of London. And it was called On the Origin of Species. He talked about variation under nature, variation under domestication, struggle for existence, and natural selection. Now, what allows a cancer stem cell to be naturally selected for kind of reminds me of when I fly across the country. I think, if I go through Chicago, I'm going to get stuck. That's a major hub. And I time it based on the time of year. I'll pick my hubs. Now, if you look at cancer stem cells, they rely on key hubs, key signaling pathways that affect self-renewal, differentiation, survival, and that the capacity to become dormant. And we're in the unique position of being able to target those hubs and work in real time to help our patients because we work together. So I'll talk about a few of those hubs and how we've targeted them in the context of myeloproliferative neoplasms, because these are disorders that evolve over time, so we can actually study in real time how the cancer stem cells evolve in actual patients. And that's because our patients are willing to work with us and are really a very strong part of the research. So when you look at myeloproliferative neoplasms, they were first described in 1951 as a set of disorders where you make too many of one type of blood cell in the marrow. They all derive from hematopoietic stem cells, and that was first suggested by John Adamson in 1976. He's one of our faculty members in hematology. And they all have varying propensities to develop acute leukemia. They can make bone marrow outside of the bone marrow in extramedullary sites like the liver and spleen. And unfortunately, they have a tendency to clot and bleed. So it gets kind of scary. You have 30-year-olds who are having strokes and heart attacks. So these are things clearly we want to change. But most of all, we want to prevent the evolution to acute leukemia and understand what are the initiating events and what are the molecular events that drive generation of cancer stem cells. The insidious thing about these disorders is often people don't know they have them. So here is a patient of mine with polycythemia vera. You know, he's plethoric. He has too much in the way of red blood cells. Didn't really notice. He was just having a lot of headaches. JAK2-driven disease. Here's another patient of mine that really did notice that she had a myeloproliferative neoplasm because she had bone marrow forming in her knee, and it was incredibly painful. Thanks to David Cherish's research and Targagen, we were able to really change everything for her. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So really, when we think of these stem cells getting on the road, or the wrong road, one of the first paths that the hematopoietic stem cell takes to go down the wrong lineage, in the case of some myeloproliferative disorders, is express a mutant JAK2 at the level of the hematopoietic stem cell. So this is done by sequencing, and you see the mutant allele in red is transmitted clonally through to the myeloid progenitor progeny, just as John Adamson had suggested in 1976. We just had to do sequencing and prospective isolation of the progenitor populations to confirm that. Now, Targagen happened to be down the street, thanks to Ida DeChaite. My very small group at the time went over there. David had done the incredible research that went into identifying the importance of this pathway and the capacity to selectively inhibit it. And so free wine and free food goes a long way. We went to Targagen's open house and decided to work together. So we also work for chocolate, by the way. Anyway. This selective JAK2 inhibitor was very interesting to us because we had a lentiviral construct where we could selectively overexpress the JAK2 mutant allele. We knew that we had good transduction efficiency because we used Roger Chen's green fluorescent protein, as we have for development of a lot of our preclinical models that are based on lentiviral overexpression of particular pathways of interest. So what we see here when we take JAK2 positive stem cells, transplant them into a mouse intrahepatically at birth, we can see engraftment by bioluminescence, and then we start treating with this oral JAK2 inhibitor over a 2-week period twice daily. And the main effect is we decrease human red blood cell engraftment. And when we really got excited was when we saw that we decreased the JAK2 mutant allele burden, which has been implicated in driving progression of disease right through to myelofibrosis and potentially increasing the rates of acute leukemia transformation. So we thought that based on the work done by ourselves and Gary Gilliland at Harvard and also our colleague at the Mayo Clinic, Ayelu Teferi, that we should move forward with this to a clinical trial, and certainly Targagen championed this. This is the case of the small company that could. Here's a patient, interestingly, that was JAK2 negative, but we think had activation of the JAK-STAT pathway. This is after 12 months of being on the JAK2 inhibitor for treatment of his myelofibrosis, which you see as this train track scarring. At 12 months, he clears out the scarring. He's been on the drug for over 24 months now. Now his cellularity has gone up. His transfusion requirements have gone down dramatically, and he started 4 businesses in the LA area, and he's doing very well financially. So he's very energetic. He didn't really realize that he wasn't energetic before starting this trial, though. He came out of an early retirement. Here's the other patient I showed you with the knee. So she has train track scarring here. That's grade 3 myelofibrosis. Average life expectancy is about 2 years, 56-year-old woman. 12 months, she's already cleared out that scarring. And she was the one on CBS Evening News last year in March. as an example of how partly CIRM-funded research or stem cell research can help us develop novel clinical trials. She continues to be in complete remission on this drug. She has no detectable splenomegaly. She has no extramedullary hematopoiesis. She has normal blood counts. She continues to take this pill, has some intermittent nausea, occasional diarrhea, but for the most part is doing almost too well because she's an accountant, so she's pretty stressed out at this time of year and very busy working full-time and looking after her mother who has multiple myeloma. So, you know, things have gone well for her, and we hope that that will continue to be the case. Certainly in the case of this phase one clinical trial, we accrued 59 patients. We saw a decrease in the JAK2 mutant allele burden in the people that had the JAK2 mutation. And so the bottom line from this trial that is now going to phase two and phase three trials through Sanofi, who invested $550 million in this economy because Targeton did such a great job with their phase one clinical trial, is that we can predict to some extent what's going to happen in clinical trials if we base the prediction on real patient samples and particular stem cell pathways. So this particular preclinical model had predictive value because it told us not only that we could decrease the JAK2 mutant allele burden, but what was different from the mouse-only models was that we predicted anemia as one of the toxicities, not pancytopenia as the mouse-only model suggested. So now, what about other diseases, unlike PV, that progress to acute leukemia far more frequently? And that's a disease called chronic myeloid leukemia. It's still one of the myeloproliferative neoplasms, but if you don't treat this disease, 100% of people will transform to blast crisis or acute leukemia. So there's something intrinsically different about the initiating event in this disease. So rather than the oncogene or the initiating tyrosine kinase event being a JAK2 mutation, here is BCR-ABL, and that's just a more potent driver of progenitor expansion. And so what happens is the hematopoietic stem cells differentiate too much into myeloid progenitors, and those progenitors don't behave. So they acquire the capacity to evade even our targeted inhibitors. Now, you know, I think that when imatinib was developed, I remember accruing patients onto the clinical trial when I was a hematology fellow at Stanford, and we were extremely enthusiastic. Here, instead of having to transplant people, which I did before, with a 25% chance of mortality in the first year, we had a pill with no mortality. The question really is, how long can we keep people on these single-agent therapies without resistance clones actually taking hold and evolving in the person? Now, when does that happen? It happens when people aren't compliant with their medication, can't tolerate their medication. And unfortunately, one of the main reasons for non-compliance are, you know, one of the main reasons that I always talk about economic impact on the patient. So once the drug gets through clinical trials, these targeted inhibitors get extremely expensive. So to be able to sustain these drugs over a long period becomes really difficult for people. So we have to devise strategies that are shorter term, combination therapy, where people can come off the drugs. And that's the transplanter in me wanting to have people cured and be able to stop. So how do we get people to come off these drugs and actually really think about making a major dent in disease? Well, that's to target self-renewal pathways and understand when they're subverted in cancer. So in terms of chronic myeloid leukemia, we see it's in this committed progenitor population called a granulocyte macrophage progenitor. As Dennis alluded to, these are the ones that serially transplant disease in these immunocompromised mice. And I think the most exciting finding that our lab has found over the last couple of years is that there seems to be missplicing of key negative regulators of self-renewal in these cells. So the missplicing is something that Kelly's going to talk about a little bit more, or at least alternative splicing in cancer, is just a common theme that we keep coming across. Here we found a missplicing glycogen synthase kinase 3 beta in this particular cellular population in 57% of patients with myeloid blast crisis CML. So that meant that they couldn't degrade a self-renewal agonist called beta-catenin, and what we found more recently is they also can't degrade sonic hedgehog pathway mediators called GLIs. So that's when we started getting involved in the sonic hedgehog story that Tanishta published in Nature. We contributed a little bit to this story, but really we're very interested in the role of Gleas in the maintenance of cancer stem cells in chronic myeloid leukemia. Now, in two previous publications, the sonic hedgehog pathway, which is a primordial self-renewal pathway used mostly by embryonic stem cells for pattern formation and self-renewal, is co-opted in cancer. So it's not used by normal hematopoietic stem cells in the adult, but it is used by the cancer stem cells. And what we see with cyclopamine, which is derived from corn lily and gives rise to cyclopia in the progeny of pregnant sheep, is that you can inhibit members of this pathway. What the preclinical mouse models didn't really tell us is which glee is really active in driving this disease. What Angela Court-Rickard and others in the lab have shown is that in people, it's really GLE2 that seems to be upregulated, and this is something that Jerry Radich had suggested before. And this is really in that leukemia stem cell context that I talked about. The other thing that Angela and Alice have recently shown is that not only do they upregulate the positive driver of the pathway, which is GLE2, they downregulate the inhibitor of the pathway called GLE3. What Anil Sridharangani showed is that when you look at sections of spleens of mice that were transplanted with leukemia stem cells and you treat them with a very selective sonic hedgehog inhibitor from Pfizer, that we downregulate GLE2 expression really dramatically. The other thing we noticed is that the effects of the sonic hedgehog inhibitor are niche dependent. So while we get dramatic responses in the spleen with a 50% reduction in spleen size in our preclinical humanized leukemia stem cell model, there's very little response in the bone marrow niche with single agent. We really have to come in with a BCR-ABL antagonist and the sonic hedgehog antagonist to really see a reduction in leukemia stem cells. And that's because there's synergy. So we upregulate negative regulators of the hedgehog pathway when we use these drugs in combination. So this work was enough provocation for Wendy Levin, who is our champion at Pfizer. The whole original preclinical modeling was made possible because of Kitty Mackey and other great people at Pfizer that we were able to work with. So we're in a clinical trial. We're actively accruing patients. This is a single agent study. The phase 1A is ongoing. We're very excited about it. It's in refractory heme malignancies. And, I think patients are really happy to be involved in it. So it's open here at UCSD, the Fred Hutch in Seattle. It's open at MD Anderson in Bologna, Italy. Now, again, Michael Caron alluded to, what about the cells that get left behind and they've gone to sleep? How do we wake them up? These are the cells that tend to go to the bone marrow niche and be next to the endosteum, and they're Ki-67 low, so they're not proliferating very much. And you can see that here, as Kristen Smith in the lab has shown. They tend to be asleep and not responsive to standard therapies. Well, that's when we started to look at the BCL2 pathway. And when you look at how we regulate our pro-survival BCL2 family members, there are six pro-survival family members. So that makes it a little complicated because you have to target all six to turn off these survival members that tend to be very highly expressed by quiescent cancer stem cells, particularly in bone metastatic cancer stem cells. So this has implications not only for leukemia, but also for solid tumors that spread to bone. So what Daniel Goff in the lab showed is that there are splice isoforms of these pro-survival BCL2 family members, particularly the long isoform that promotes survival, and all of them are upregulated. So if you just looked at total amounts of BCL2, MCL1, BCLXL, and BFL1, you'd miss the signature. The real signature here, or biomarker, if you'd like to call it that, is the splice isoform, and it's the long one that promotes survival. What Daniel showed in patients is that as you go from chronic phase to blast crisis, you really upregulate BCL2 protein, and what he's shown more recently is that's in the bone metastatic niche, or in the bone marrow microenvironment, more than in the spleen or extramedullary sites. So we've been very excited to work with Peggy Wentworth, from Coronado Biosciences originally, with this compound developed at the Burnham by John Reed and Maurizio Pellecchia to try and inhibit these BCL2 family member expressing recalcitrant cancer stem cells in the bone marrow niche. And what they did was they derivatized apagosipol and made a very potent compound called 9-7-C1 that's now called sabutoclax. And with this compound, the reason we think it's so important is that unlike other pan-BCL2 antagonists, or so-called pan-BCL2 antagonists, it actually inhibits MCL1 and BFL1. And what we find from the RNA sequencing signature that we're getting on the leukemia stem cells is that these are highly upregulated in leukemia stem cells, the MCL1 and BFL1. You'd only know that by looking at the particular cellular context and the environment that those cells end up in. So what Daniel noticed is when he compared the capacity of Abbott 737 to inhibit normal stem cells, they looked very similar. But when you look at blast crisis leukemia and the Abbott versus the sabutoclax compound, there's a better therapeutic index, and the sabutoclax is just far more potent than the Abbott compound, particularly in the bone niche where we have trouble getting rid of those dormant cancer stem cells. So we're very excited to move ahead with new CIRM funding as soon as we get that, and to get involved in really developing this compound as a major building block for highly active anti-leukemia stem cell therapy, and then move that on to highly active anti-cancer stem cell therapy, particularly with people that have bone metastatic disease. Now, here in vivo, we see very little effect on normal stem cells engrafted in vivo, but the cancer stem cells are really very, very sensitive to this drug if they've activated the pathway. So really what we're left with is this model of molecular evolution of cancer stem cells. What we've talked about so far is really the preclinical modeling and then getting into the clinical trial. And I think what Kelly Frazier, our director of genomics, has really allowed us to do is reverse translation, as David Tarrant put it, which means understanding why our patients are responding in some cases and why they're not responding in other cases in real time, so we can make decisions appropriately for the individual and have them be the driver and say, these are the changes we've seen in your malignancy over time. I'd like to give them a stem cell fitness report. This is your complement of normal stem cells. They're doing okay, but unfortunately you have these cancer stem cells sitting over here that are dormant. We can look at the quiescent fraction. We can look at whether survival pathways are activated and look not only at the RNA level but the DNA level, at whether these aberrant differentiation pathways are activated, whether it's aberrant self-renewal and aberrant survival, so that we can wipe out this fraction of cells that tends to resist standard chemotherapy and really get patients on the road to being able to reclaim their lives and not be worried all the time about relapse. And that's what I call the Damocles sword phenomenon, where people are always waiting for that sword to drop. So I'll let Kelly go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. So for the past 18 months or so, I've been working here at Morris Cancer Center with Katrina Jameson, as well as other physician scientists, trying to bring into patient care high-throughput sequencing. And what we have here is we've brought on two different platforms, high-throughput platforms. We have both the Solid 4 platform, which is from Life Technologies, as well as the HiSeq 2000, which is an Illumina platform. And we have brought on the computational power, having sufficient CPUs as well as workspace to be able to analyze the data coming out of these machines and sufficient archiving ability for these data. The machines are actually housed at the sequencers themselves are here on the third floor. If you're interested in seeing them, please stop by. The computational power is actually co-localized at the San Diego supercomputer. So the sequencers themselves, they output data in a very similar format, regardless of what the experimental design or the question is. But what we have up front is, you know, we can address many different experimental questions. And these are called either by using like a whole genome sequencing method or a transcriptome sequencing method or an exome sequencing method. And in transcriptome, what we're looking at is the expressed part of the human genome, that which is transcribed. In the exome sequencing, what we're looking at is its actual DNA, but it's the coding part. We go into the DNA and we pull out just the sequences that are coding and analyze those by sequencing. Depending on the sample prep method that you use, although the data coming out of this machine is in the same format, the analysis methods for those different sample preps are very different. So we've not only had to put in place the sample preps, but the different types of analysis methods. We have all of these different methods for discovery currently in our use that we're using. And in addition, we have what we call an application method, which is ultra-deep targeted sequencing. This is where we've chosen about 100 kb of frequently mutational hotspots in cancer, and we sequence those to a very ultra-deep depth. And so what I'm going to focus on here is the work we've been doing with Katrina Jameson, which is really focused on these two methods here, transcriptome sequencing and exome sequencing. So again, transcriptome sequencing is where we're analyzing the expressed portion of the genome. And what the high-throughput sequencing allows us to do is it allows us to get a very detailed structure of the genes that are expressed. And what I mean by that is there's about 25,000 genes in the human genome. And currently, most people with arrays and stuff are looking at these genes as if they're one unit. But we know that for each of these genes, there's multiple isoforms. There's, you know, three, there can be up to 1,000 different isoforms for a particular gene. And they can come in different formats. You can have, this is TRIM28, you can have isoforms that have the same transcriptional start sites, or you can have isoforms that have different transcriptional start sites. And you can have isoforms that have different exons that are coding in there. So there are many, many more exon isoforms than there are actually genes. And one can see by looking at this, it's not hard to envision the fact that these three isoforms probably have different functions. So with Katrina in the CIRM-funded stem cell therapy program or project, we've performed and analyzed RNA-seq on over 20 different samples. What I'm going to focus on right now is these two samples here, one of which is from a normal individual, CD34-positive, 38-positive, and one that's been isolated from a CML patient in a blast crisis stage, CD34-positive, 38-positive. What you can see here is that from all of the ones that we've done, we've been looking at different patients, you know, normal state, some of which have been treated with drugs, some of which have not been treated or been treated with vehicles, and some which have not been treated at all. Now, this is one way to visualize the RNA-seq data. So what we're looking at, because from the CML blast crisis, it's important to look at BCL2 family members. These are survival genes. And so what we're looking at here is MCL1 and BCL2A. Now, here is the RNA-seq coverage that we have. And what we have is the RNA-seq coverage for the normal sample versus for the CMLBC sample in gray and blue, respectively. And these are the different isoforms that we're looking at. And what we can see is that there's no expression change in two of these isoforms between the normal and the CMLBC sample. However, for two of the isoforms, it's significantly higher expression in the CMLBC. And interestingly, for the CML1, the isoforms, the long form isoforms, the ones that are actually expressed higher in the CMLBC patient, these are pro-survival isoforms. And so these are very functionally different than the shorter isoforms, which are actually promote apoptosis and therefore are pro-death. For the BCL2A, we note, again, for the normal versus the CMLBC sample, that there are isoforms that are expressed higher in the CMLBC versus the normal sample. Now, if you recall from Katrina Jameson's discussion earlier in this talk, that the 97C1 targets all the BCL2 family members, including these two genes, whereas the ABT-737 does not target these two genes. And the 97C1 actually is a more potent inhibitor of cancer stem cells. And therefore, what this data is giving us is some hints into why this may be a more potent inhibitor, because it actually targets not just some of the BCL2 family members, but these also, which have different expression patterns. So just to summarize, that RNA-seq analysis is really providing insights into why the broad-spectrum BCL2 family inhibitor, the 97C1, works better at targeting CML cancer stem cells than the ABT-737, which only targets two of the BCL2 family members. And now for exome sequencing, again, what we're doing is pulling out the coding parts of the genome and sequencing those. We've performed an analysis on a patient that had CMML and progressed into AML. And what we did, or what Katrina Jameson's group did, is they fact-sorted the sample obtained from the patient at this stage into CD34 positive and CD34 negative populations, cancer stem cell and the non-stem cell population, as well as after progression into AML, fact-sorted into these same two populations. And what the colors here are supposed to be indicating here is that from this particular tumor, it's a heterogeneous population, and as you sort it, you'll get more homogeneous populations that you identify or that you can analyze, and that the population changes over time, and so that the mix of the cells that are present here will be different than the other populations. And so looking at the exome sequences of these four different populations, as well as comparing them to the germline itself. So the germline is what tells us what is the patient's normal DNA sequence. We were able to identify that there were some genes that had mutations in them, specifically Notch2, that were present in all the different tumors. Now, interestingly, GLE3, the mutation that we found in GLE3, was only present in the stem cell population that after progression into AML. And if you remember, Katrina was talking about GLE3, which is a member of the hedgehog family, and it's likely to be playing an important role in the progression, as well as should be considered when making therapy considerations for this particular patient. Interestingly, this was something I did not expect to find, where in the WNT8A gene, we found that there were mutations in the CD34 minus population in the CMML isolated sample. And there were also mutations after in the AML, the CD34 positive. But these were actually not in the exact same spot, suggesting that perhaps the mutations, that the cells that had the mutations here may have died out and given rise in that this gene was mutated twice in different components, populations of this tumor. So exome sequencing on germline as well as assorted populations is really going to enable the heterogeneous nature of tumors to be better characterized. And I'd like to thank many of the people who contributed to this work, the Genome Informations Group that is working here with me in the Cancer Center, the many members of the Dr. Jameson's lab here at UC San Diego, the many members, our collaborators, both international collaborators as well as those here at UC San Diego and neighboring institutes, and last but not least, the industrial partners that we have, as well as our funding sources. Thank you very much.